A little bit about the Haggadah. So the Haggadah is, of course, the name of the book that we use at the Passover Seder. That's the name of the book. It's a very, very ancient book. It goes back, as we're going to see, in its basic form to the earliest days of Judaism. Judaism, we date back to over 3,300 years ago. In its current form, as we have it today, it's well over 1,000 years old. Now, what's fascinating is Jews were spread out throughout the world. And while the commandments of the Torah tend to be, they are 100% the same for all Jews. There's variations in varying customs and traditions from community to community. The foods we eat, the clothing we wear, and even how we observe different things. There are slight variations, mostly due to custom. Sometimes there's a halachic dispute where rabbis in one place took one halachic perspective and the rabbis in a different area took a different halachic perspective, often Ashkenazi Sephardi differences, but they're very slight. But what tends to happen is that the older something is in its Jewish traditions, the more unanimous it will be, the more everyone will be doing the same. When it comes to the Haggadah, every single Jewish community has virtually the same Haggadah. The end part, the piyotim, the poems that we read at the end, that varies from one community to the next. But the Haggadah itself, the proper Haggadah, that is the same with very, very slight variances from one community to the next. But almost always it's 99% the same. And so it really shows how old the Haggadah is. And the Haggadah has become, in many ways, one of the most important works in Judaism. Firstly, I believe the Haggadah, I've never seen a number as to how many printings there are of the Haggadah. I saw someone had a list of 40,000, but I believe the Haggadah has been printed more than any other work in history, more than the Torah itself. And that's because every single Jew needs a Haggadah every year, and I guess a lot of Jews lost last year's Haggadahs, so they need new Haggadahs for this year, and this has been happening throughout history. So there's an enormous number of printed Haggadahs, an enormous number of Haggadah manuscripts. Every Jewish family had a Haggadah manuscript, right? A lot of people didn't have prayer books. They would have the cantor would have the prayer book and read and everyone would listen. But the Haggadah, you did it at home. So everyone had their own Haggadah manuscript, so that we have countless Haggadah manuscripts. There are also, as a result, understandably, countless commentaries on the Haggadah. There are at least a few thousand commentaries that we know of on the Haggadah that were written. And there's certainly many more that have been lost. So the Haggadah has become really this kind of really, really important work in Judaism. Of course, that we use, every Jew uses every year at the Seder when they read the Haggadah. So the Haggadah can refer to really two different things. It can refer to the instructions for the Seder, which is the order of things that we do on the eve of Passover. All the kind of entire service or the entire structure of what we do is referred to as Seder. And so the Haggadah, which comes from the word lahagid, to tell, right? And from the word, the Torah tells us that we must tell the story of the Exodus. Can refer to the Seder, all the instructions of everything we're supposed to be doing at the Seder, which is what it usually refers to. Sometimes it can refer to just the actual telling of the story, which is found in one part of this usually divided into 15 steps or so, depending on how you divide it. The one of those steps is telling the story of the Exodus, and that would be Haggadah, to actually tell the story. So the Haggadah as is, and we'll talk about the entire Haggadah. What does it include today? So there's different ways that we can divide it. It's often divided, as I said, into 15 steps, or sometimes 14 or 16. There's different ways of counting the steps, but it's divided into particular steps. But it can be divided in a different way. And I'm going to divide it in a totally different way for our class, which is, firstly, there are the mitzvot, the commandments that we fulfill at the Seder. Now, commandments would go back to Moses. They would be ancient. They would go back to the commandments in the Torah. They go all the way back to Moses. Then there are what we call rabbinic additions, right? Anyone familiar with Judaism knows that there are many what we call rabbinic laws, rabbinic rules. Now, it's a bit of a misnomer. It's misunderstood, the term rabbinic. And I think I've mentioned this in some of my classes before. I've mentioned this fairly often, something I like to stress, that people think rabbinic, well, they're made by the rabbis, right? And so I'm a rabbi, right? Can I make rabbinic law? The answer is no. Rabbinic is a translation of the Hebrew word midrabanan, from the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan we're referring to in this term is the members of the Sanhedrin, of the Supreme Council of Judaism. So for the first 1700 years or so of Jewish history, we had a Supreme Council, a Sanhedrin. They were the final arbitrators. They had the final say in Judaism, in Jewish law. And so they also had the authority, as stated clearly in the Torah, they have the authority to create their own laws and legislate as they felt needed, and create their own mitzvot, their own what we call rabbinic mitzvot, mitzvot de Rabbanan. And so they created additions. Now, when did the rabbinic mitzvot, when would the rabbinic mitzvot be added? So rabbinic mitzvot would be added any time from the days of Moses until the Sanhedrin was disbanded in about the early 300s. Now, the truth is that we know that the last 200 years or so of the Sanhedrin, they weren't really doing any legislating. It was not that active, and they were mostly working on the calendar, and they were not legislating that much in the last 200 years. So that then pulls us back to the first 1500 years of Judaism, but it could be any time during that period. Some rabbinic laws, we have specific ways of knowing when exactly it was legislated. Most of them, we don't. However, we do know that most of the rabbinic laws that we do know when they were legislated in the earliest periods of Judaism. In other words, in the first 400 or 500 years before the days of, or by the days of King David and Solomon at the latest. So it's those first 500 years were the crucial, that's when Judaism really began to, the rabbinic laws began impacted in a way that it began to look the way it looks today. And Judaism really began to evolve and take shape of what we know today. So it's then really, really, really ancient. We're talking about, King David's 2,900 years ago, close to 3,000 plus years ago. And then, of course, there are customs at the Seder that come much later, right? Now, some of those customs are found in the Haggadah. There's a lot of family customs that are not mentioned in the Haggadahs, but we just, family customs, or some Haggadahs from particular places mention local custom. So let's break these things down, the mitzvot, the rabbinic additions, and the customs. So the mitzvot of the Seder include eating matzah. It's a mitzvah to eat matzah on the night of the Seder. Last year, if you recall, we did a class on the matzah itself. While the Haggadah is the same as it's been for the last 3,000 years, the matzah is not, right? We mentioned that matzahs change, right? We talked about that. Eating maror, which there actually is a debate, but according to many opinions, maror is no longer a biblical obligation, but only a rabbinic obligation. It was only a biblical obligation when we offered a Passover sacrifice, but now it's no longer biblical, but definitely was always done. And the third mitzvah that we have is telling the story of the Exodus. Those are the three mitzvot, biblical commands to do on the night of Passover: eating matzah, eating maror, bitter herbs, and telling the story of the Exodus. The most important mitzvah of the Passover night, the kind of climax of the Passover Seder, no longer exists. That was offering the Passover sacrifice. They would take a lamb, they would take it to the temple where they would slaughter it in the temple, and its blood would be placed on the altar and its fats would be burned on the altar. Then they would bring the lamb home. They would roast it, the entire lamb together, open it over an open flame. And then they would eat that Passover sacrifice. That was the climax of the Seder.
That was
so we don't have that anymore, right? So in the original Seder, they would first eat their meal, as we do today, and afterwards, instead of eating the Afikomen, they would eat the Passover sacrifice as for dessert. Today, we don't have Passover sacrifice. We eat matzah instead. More matzah. We already ate matzah earlier. We eat more matzah. Now, we also do other things, like placing a shank bone, and some people put a chicken bone on the Seder plate in order to commemorate the Passover sacrifice. So we do various things to commemorate it. The Seder plate as we have it today varies from community to community, by the way, unlike the Haggadah itself. And the Seder plate, a lot of the kind of its, while there always was a plate, its current structure is somewhat recent, last couple hundred years. So in the temple times, though, there was also an additional thing that they did, another mitzvah. Besides eating the Passover sacrifice, before they eating the Passover sacrifice, they first had dinner. What did they eat for the dinner? they would eat meat. What meat would they eat? They would eat the Chagiga sacrifice. So earlier in the day, the Passover sacrifice was offered in the afternoon. Earlier in the day, they would bring another sacrifice called a Chagiga sacrifice that would be slaughtered, its blood placed on the altar, its fats burned on the altar, and the animal brought home. This would not be roasted. This would rather be cooked regularly, and they would have that for their dinner, and then only have the Passover sacrifice at the end for dessert.
What is a Chagiga?
Chagiga comes from the word Chag. Chag is festival, celebrate. Chagiga is celebratory sacrifice. No, it could be any animal. Could be any animal, yeah. The Passover sacrifice had to be a lamb, goat or sheep, male or female, while the it had to be a lamb within its first year. More than a week old, but less than a year old. The Chagiga could be any animal. Any kosher cow, sheep, or goat is really the only things that you could bring. So those were the original biblical commands. We also have one more that's not directly related to the Seder, which is that after you eat, it's a mitzvah. The Torah says you have to thank Hashem. You have to say a blessing. And our tradition is at the beginning, at least, of the Birchat HaMazon, the blessing that we have after food, was composed by Moses because they had a blessing straight away to say. It's not clear that it was the same blessing that we say today in its current form. It may have evolved. But they would have said a blessing, thanking Hashem for the food at the end, as we do today, the Birchat HaMazon, the blessing after eating. And that's also a biblical command. And that would have been done from the earliest times. So, biblical Seder would have been, if we kind of want to reimagine what a Seder in Moses' days would have looked like, right? They would have had, started their Seder, they would have had eaten, tell the story, have the matzah, the maror, the Passover sacrifice sitting in front of them while they eat the story, right, sitting on the table in front of them in a Seder plate while they eat, while they tell the story of the Exodus. And we'll soon tell you what telling the story involves. Then they would have eaten matzah. Then they would have eaten maror, bitter herbs. Then they would take out the korban chagiga, the chagiga sacrifice, and eat that as their dinner together with whatever other foods they may have served. And then they would conclude by eating the Passover sacrifice. And then they would do the blessing after the meal, right? That's what the original Passover Seder looked like. Not all that different, somewhat different, but not all that different from our own. Now, in the early days of Judaism, there were already additions added. Our sages said that we should drink 4 cups of wine. Now, sages in general, we're not sure when this began, but they created this thing that whenever we do anything of great importance, such as a mitzvah to announce that Shabbat is beginning, kiddush, or announce that Shabbat is ending, havdalah, they say whenever you do that, do it with a cup of wine. Or if you make a blessing at a wedding, do it with 7 blessings we make, do it with a cup of wine. Or you make a blessing at an erusin, which is kind of a first stage part of the wedding, we do both now today together, do it with a cup of wine, right? Or a blessing at a bris, do it with a cup of wine. We throw in wine to everything. Why wine? Because wine is simply...
Why not?
Why not, right? Why do you need an excuse for a cup of wine? Exactly. Or simply because wine is a very prestigious drink. It still remains the most prestigious drink. You want to serve something nice, fancy, you serve wine. And so it adds prestige to the event, to the occasion. So they said that we should drink 4 cups of wine at our Seder. And they gave us, not just to drink 4 cups to get down 4 cups, but 4 cups for 4 specific things. First, they said, just as is a biblical command before and after Shabbat to mark the beginning and end of Shabbat with an announcement, and the sages said, do it with a cup of wine, they also, separately, although there's no biblical command, the sages said, the Sanhedrin said, in the early days of Judaism, every Yom Tov, every holiday, you should mark the beginning of the holiday and the end of the holiday with a cup of wine, with announcing the holiness of the holiday with a cup of wine. So we do kiddush. It's not a biblical command. It's a rabbinic command. We do kiddush at the beginning, at the end of each holiday. So the first cup of wine you're going to use for kiddush. Then they said, when you tell the story of the Exodus, do with a cup of wine sitting in front of you, and then at the end, drink the wine. Then, for the blessing after the meal, they actually said, probably around the same time when they added wine to everything, maybe it was a single Sanhedrin, maybe it happened over time, we don't know, that they said that when we do the blessing after the meal, which again we said was a biblical command, Moshe wrote the original blessing, later additional blessings were added, today we have four blessings. They said, whenever you do the blessing after the meal, you should always do it with a cup of wine. Now, that instruction is one of those that never really took off. And we have rules, if sages give instructions and they don't take off, then we're not obligated by them. That was one that never really took off. People felt it was a little bit too much wine. Every time you have dinner and you have and you do the blessing after the meal to then drink a cup of wine, it was a little much wine to drink. People didn't have wine. Wine was expensive. And so that was probably the bigger issue, not the alcohol, the expense. And so people didn't bother doing it. When they had a large group, a minyan together, 10 Jews, doing the blessing after the meal together, then the custom is that we use a cup of wine. But at the Seder, they said, well, when you do the blessing after the meal, that will be your third cup of wine. So we've said the blessing of the after meal, holding our third cup of wine and drink it at the end. And then they added an additional command to sing Hallel praises to God. Thank God for the Exodus. They chose a number of verses from Psalms, chapter 113 through 118, that we should always read as Hallel, as praises to God. And we read it every Yom Tov, every holiday, except for we read it the first day or first 2 days in that diaspora of Passover and Shavuot, Sukkot, and Shmini Atzeret, and Hanukkah. In the diaspora, of course, we added a day to all that. They said we should praise God, and we should also do it at our Seder, and you should do it with a cup of wine, and then at the end drink the fourth cup.
So which came first, doing that Hallel as a thing we do on Chagim, or doing the Hallel on the Seder?
We don't know. Which one came first, the Hallel on the holidays or the Hallel at the Seder? We don't know. So in addition to these four cups, they also told us that we should eat a vegetable before telling the story. Now, why should we eat a vegetable before telling the story of, in other words, after we do our kiddush, before we actually bother telling the story of the Exodus, which was originally the first step, we should first eat a vegetable. Why eat a vegetable? Well, they didn't give us a reason. They rather said it should be in order that people should ask, why are we eating a vegetable, to get people, children, to start asking questions. They all said we should dip the vegetable into salt water. That became one of the questions. Why do you dip the vegetable into salt water? And because we get the vegetable wet, we are required now to wash our hands beforehand. They commanded that whenever you eat wet food, you should always wash your hands before eating it. Again, a command that's not was never widely accepted and not widely observed, and therefore not one is not obligated to do so. However, for the Seder, we continue to do so. And they also created the custom of dipping a maror into charoset, and they also created, they said, in general, they require before we eat bread, we always have to wash our hands, and so we have the washing the hands also. So now, as you can see, now we have a Seder that takes on a much more, a view that looks very, very similar to our Seder today. So if we think of the Seder, we don't know exactly when all these things were added, these various additions. We do know that the blessings, probably the wording that we have today for Kiddush, the blessing that we do at the end of the telling the story, the blessing on the Hallel, blessings generally were created by the men of the Great Assembly. So these were made at least by the men of the Great Assembly, perhaps which the Great Assembly, the Knesia Gdola, or the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, was around at the very, very end of the, or in the first 40 years of the Second Temple, according to our tradition, that would be about 2,400 years ago, so just before the Greek conquest. So if we kind of think of it the way they had in the days of the men at 2,400 years ago, what did their Seder look like? Well, first they filled up a cup of wine, they said the Kiddush, and as we know it today, they drank the wine. Then they would wash their hands and eat the vegetable dipped in salt water. Then The washing the hands, we know where it came from, the days of Solomon. We're told that. Then they would tell the story of the Exodus, conclude it with drinking a second cup of wine. Then they would wash their hands, eat matzah. Then they would eat maror dipped in the charoset. Then they would eat their dinner, which would consist of the chagiga sacrifice. Then they would eat that Passover sacrifice for afikoman. Then they would say the blessing after the meal over a third cup of wine, and then they would recite the Hallel over a fourth cup of wine. In other words, our Seder, as we know it today, is almost the same, sans the sacrifices, as they did 2,400 years ago. We're only missing the sacrifices, but otherwise it's virtually the same. Hasn't changed all that much in all these years, right? So we've been doing the same thing, and that would explain why all Jews do the same thing, because we've always been doing this. Yeah. We've been doing this for a very, very, very long time. Now, the biggest changes would have come with the destruction of the temple. So with the destruction of the temple, the Sanhedrin managed to escape Jerusalem in a story of its own and move to Yavne. And in Yavne, they reconvened, and led by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, they made a whole series of rules for Judaism to commemorate the destruction of the temple, as well as changing many wording of many blessings and the like. They would have been presumably the ones who said, instead of, well, we don't have the Passover sacrifice, instead, put a bone on your table, instead, eat afikoman. At the end, you don't have the chagiga sacrifice, but you can still have whatever you're eating for dinner. Presumably, the people outside of Jerusalem, who were, for whatever reason, didn't make the pilgrimage that year, most Jews would come for the pilgrimage to Jerusalem when there was a temple, but if they couldn't make it, presumably they still made a Seder, and they would have done it similar to the way we do it today, without the chagiga and Passover sacrifices. Did they eat matzah for the afikoman? We don't know. Maybe. So that covers the general structure of the Haggadah itself. And now I'm going to get to the actual story, which we haven't touched on yet. That's subject of its own. Any questions?
No.
No? Okay. So, but what we do know is now that the very basics of our Seder go back to Moses. The Seder, pretty much the structure as we recognize today, was the same 2,400 years ago, only they had sacrifices, which we don't have anymore. But otherwise, it was pretty much the same. It looked almost identical to the way we have it today. Now, at the center of the Haggadah is what we call Magid, the part that we tell the story. Now, here the details are old, but not as old. They're much of it is over 2,000 years old. Some of it is over 1,000 years old. We could say at least how far it goes, though we don't know for certain. So the basic structure of the Haggadah is already found in the Mishnah in Psachim, which was written around the year 200. Much of the rest of the text, in other words, the Mishnah kind of has some short form, read from here to here, right? Read, Doreshet Me'arami Oved Avi, right? Read from this part to this part. It doesn't tell you, right, where to find the text that you're supposed to read, but we know the text that it's telling us is found in a book called Sifri, which is from the same period as the Mishnah that has the text the Mishnah is telling us from here to here. So it's likely then the Haggadah preceded both books, both the Sifri and the Mishnah. In other words, it was very, very old. In fact, we're pretty certain that the Haggadah, at least the basics of the Haggadah, was around during the Second Temple period. Because we know that the Mishnah tells us that in the Haggadah, they had four questions, right? It starts with four questions, right? Now, the four questions we know today are, why do we eat matzah? Why do we eat maror? Why do we dip? And why do we lean? Why do we recline? Back then, instead of asking about reclining, they asked, why are we only eating roast? What were they eating? The Passover sacrifice. So they were, so that, and they didn't ask about reclining because it probably wasn't that unusual. They always reclined when they ate in Greek times, in Roman times. So it wasn't that unusual, right? But then after the destruction of the temple, they pulled out the roast one, and instead they put in the roast question, and instead they put in reclining. So, but we know that they had then four questions during the days of the Second Temple already, right?
Okay.
So they had the questions. This goes all the way back to the Second Temple. They had four questions. And the Mishnah tells us that then after that, they would then proceed to tell the story. Now, in the Talmud, it gives us two opinions as to how to start. Where does the story start from? So one opinion says that you start from the verse Avadim Hayino Leparo Lebimitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. Another opinion says, which is a verse in the Torah describing the Exodus, and describing what a parent should tell their child when their child asks them, why do you do all these things? Another verse that the Talmud, another opinion says, we should start from the words, Mitchila of de Avodah Zarah. Originally, our fathers were idolaters, referring to Terach, the grandfather of Abraham. So, presumably, there were two different versions of the Haggadah, around back then. One that started the kind of telling the story with the verse Avadim Hayinu. One that started with the verse Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah. Today we do both. We essentially merge both versions. We start with Avadim Hayinu, and then we say Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah. We do both. We do both versions. Then after that, the Mishnah tells us that we're supposed to read the story of the Exodus. Now, the Torah says to read the story of the Exodus, right? To tell the story. How do you tell the story of the Exodus? You go to the book. So you could read the book originally. You could read kind of from the story of from the book of Exodus and tell the story, the whole thing that way, tell the entire story. That would be a lot of reading to do. You'd have a very, very long Haggadah if you did that, right? Because you're talking about a couple of chapters worth, right? But actually, the Torah itself retells the story of the Exodus. In short, well, it does in the verse Avadim Hayino, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt and God took us out. It says in about one line, when your child asks you, you should answer them. But then there's a mitzvah in the Torah that if a farmer in Israel should take their first fruit, the first fruit they grow, and bring them to Jerusalem. And over there, it says they should say as follows. They should say, Arami Oved Avi, my father was the Aramean. Attempt to destroy my father, and it's another way to translate it. My father was a lost Aramean, what the correct translation is a subject of its own, but usually translated at least by Rashi and by most commentaries as the Aramean attempted to destroy my father, and he went down to Egypt, and then it describes the slavery and how they were redeemed from slavery and how they came out, and God took them out with a strong hand and outstretched arm. And miracles and wonders. And so it describes about four verses. The Torah describes the Exodus. The Torah tells us how a person bringing first fruit should tell the story of the Exodus. So that's what we read, the way the Torah tells us to tell the story of the Exodus. However, you don't read it as is. What we do is we do drash. Drash is that every word in the Torah and every letter is there to teach us something. And so the drash essentially takes every word and says, well, what is this word teaching us? What is that word teaching us, right? What is this alluding to? What is that alluding to? So we have books of drash, right? Notable is Sifri, which is a drash on the books of Bamidbar and Devarim, Numbers and Deuteronomy, that essentially do exactly that. We have many books of drash that explain each word in the Torah what it's coming to teach you. In recent years, a fellow called Rabbi Kasher put together a book called Torah Shlema, where he did on 4 out of 5 volumes of the Torah, where he collected it all together in one place. We could get all the drash to know what each word is telling you from all different sources. So it's not enough just to read these verses, but the Mishnah says you have to do the drash. You have to do the expounded reading of the verses, in other words, explaining what each word is coming to tell you. So that's what we do. We read a verse. If you actually read the Haggadah carefully, you'll see this is what it does. We read the first verse, Aramido Oveda Viva Yerim Mitzrayim Yakasham Seimad Visham the Gogadala Tumarov, which is the first verse. And the Aramean attempted to destroy my father, and he went down to Egypt. He lived there with few in number and became over there into a great, mighty, strong nation. And then we proceed to read the drash. right? And we read each detail. He went to Vayered Mitzrayim. He went down to Egypt. It teaches us that he didn't go to live there permanently. He only went there to live temporarily. And it goes and explains each detail and each word what it is coming to teach you. And this drash is actually found, as I mentioned, in the book of Sifri. It's found in the Sifri, with some variations in our current Sifri. But it was a drash that they originally had. And so they would read that drash as we have it today. And then... Then the final thing that we do is we read the first two chapters of Hallel. Our sages say normally we read the entire Hallel together when we read it on a holiday, which is chapters 113 through 118. However, at the Seder, our sages split it. We do 113 and 114 at the beginning of the Seder, at the end of the story of the story of the Exodus, and then we do 115 through 118 at the end after our meal. So read the next two chapters, and then they wrote a blessing. The men of the Great Assembly wrote a blessing that we should recite and then drink our second cup of wine. So that's the way the Mishnah describes the Seder. That's what they would have done in the days of the Mishnah, almost 2,000 years ago. It almost certainly went back to the Second Temple period. We can guess, we don't know for certain, that this was, that this Haggadah as we know it was then compiled by the men of the Great Assembly, who are responsible for many of the rituals that we know today, the rabbinic rituals that we have today in Judaism. Very possible that they compiled it as we have it today, or in that kind, in at least something similar to what we have today. Now, I'm sure you're wondering, there are other parts of the Haggadah as well that we didn't touch on. So there were, after this, after the Mishnah, in a later time, a number of additions were later made to the Haggadah. What were those additions? Well, we added a paragraph at the very beginning of the story that starts with the words, Hey Lachma Anya, this is the bread of affliction. This is a prayer, this is a statement that's in Aramaic. And it is, and it wishes for us to go back to the land of Israel. Clearly, it was written in the diaspora in Babylon, right? It was written by Jews in Babylon and began to be read by Jews in Babylon. We also added, after the four questions and after the first Avadim Hayino, the statement that we were slaves, we also added a Braita, which is a Mishnaic era teaching about five sages who told the story of the Exodus all night. We also added a Mishnah from Brachot that mentions the Exodus twice, that tells us that we are obligated to mention the Exodus twice every single day, Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. We also added a Braita from also from the Sifri that asks, that discusses when we're supposed to recite the Haggadah. Maybe we should do it on the first day of the month, right? How do we know that we're doing it on the 15th of Nisan? And it brings the biblical source, the scriptural source, where it alludes to the fact that we do it from the word Bayom Ahu Bavur Zeh, that it must be on the that it must be read on the eve of Passover at your Seder. So we added those brightas to kind of the beginning part of the Haggadah. The Halach Ma'anya was added, the Braita and the Mishnahs were mentioned, were added. The Sifri probably is older. The Mishnah and the Braita mentioned the name of sages that lived in the early 100s. So certainly, the first Mishnah that actually lived in the mid-100s, the second Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, lived a little bit earlier in the early 100s, but they clearly, those Mishnahs were added after those sages were lived. We then also at the end, after telling the story of the Haggadah, we add a Braita that tells us about additional numbers of plagues. That gives us three different opinions as to, says that there were five times as many plagues on the sea as there were on the in Egypt. And then opinions that say that, no, there were more than 10 plagues to start with. There were 40 plagues or 50 plagues with five times as many on the sea. So that Braita would have been added later. Again, it's from sages that lived in the late mid-second century. We then also add a Braita from Rabban Gamliel, who lived again in the Rabban Gamliel, who lived in the early second century, who says that we must say three things on Passover: Pesach, Matzah, Maror, and describing each one of those three things. And we conclude with a Braita, which has similarities at least to a Mishnah about the obligation to see ourselves as if we left Egypt. So also, again, from that same second century period. So it's clear that these brayters were added after the second century. We don't know when. Halach Ma'ani was added in Babylon. Judaism, really kind of the center of Judaism, moved from Israel to Babylon in the early third century. So sometime in the third century, sometime after from the third century on, all these additions were added. Presumably fairly early on, evidenced by the fact that everyone does the same. The earliest Siddur we have is the Siddur of Rav Amram Gaon, which was written in the 900s, in the 800s, and then we have a Siddur of Rav Sadia Gaon, written about a century later. And then we have, after that, we have many Siddurim. So they all have the Haggadah, pretty much as we have it today. So they seem to be mostly in place by Rav Amram Gaon. It's not exactly the same. The Haggadah, exactly as we see it today, is already found. The students of Rashi, who lives in the 11th century, or 12th, the early 12th century, wrote various Sidurim. There's Machzor Vitri and the Siddur Rashi. A number of Sidurim were written by Rashi's students. And those already have the Haggadah exactly as we see it today. So to get back to our original question, who was the original author of the Haggadah? Well, we don't know who the author was. It doesn't have a name to it. So we can identify a person. But the basics of the Seder was already in the place in the days of Moses. Most of the additions that we recognize today were added in the early days of Judaism, and certainly in place by the days of the men of the Great Assembly, 2,400 years ago. The Haggadah, as we know it today, most of it probably existed during the Second Temple period, but was certainly in place by the second century. The bulk of it may have been written by the men of the Great Assembly 2,400 years ago. We don't know exactly when and who. No, the men of the Great Assembly were before beginning of the Second Temple, 2,400 years ago, going way back, right? The Gaonim are from about the year 500 to 1,000. Now, some parts were added in Talmudical Gaonic times, the additional brayters that were added later. They were probably added in earlier times, hard to know exactly when. They probably were added in Talmudic times, evidenced by the fact that everyone seems to have them. So the universal Haggadah that we have today is certainly over 1,000 years old. As I mentioned at the beginning, it's universal, we all have it the same. So it's certainly over 1,000 years old. It's likely closer to 1,600-1,700 years old. And the basics of the Haggadah, again, the basic outline of the Haggadah that we have today, without those minor additions, was certainly around 1,800 years ago, likely around sometime before that. The basic structure of the Haggadah goes back 2,400 years, and the basic Seder goes back to Moses, 3,300 years. So we're going way back when we sit at the Haggadah and just think about it. When you sit at the Seder this year, that you're sitting at a Seder for the last 3,300 years, millions of Jews and who knows how many different places around the world have done the same thing and sat and made the same Seder, same rituals, same matzah, even if it didn't taste the same as our matzah today, same maror, right? Everything was the same as it was 3,300 years ago, and it hasn't changed. The evolution was pretty early on, and it hasn't changed that much. So I wish you all a happy and kosher Passover.